Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
All right. This is weird, by the way. It's a little weird. I think actually I'm just not going to look at you. That's what I'm going to do.
All right. We'll both keep our eyes down.
I'm not going to look at you. Eyes down straight ahead. Hey, everybody, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Making today make sense is what we're doing on this pod.
And I'm Kimberly Adams, sitting in the D.C. Bureau with Kai actively not looking at me.
No, it's just bizarre. So I'm in town for some other stuff, and we're in a, 10 by 10 little booth here, and it's just bizarre. That's all I'm saying.
And don't worry, we both tested negative COVID very recently. But thank you for joining us for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, the day that we answer your questions. You can email those questions to makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-UB-SMART. First up, a voicemail, which I think is pegged to our deep dive last week with the economist, Professor Bill Spriggs, about the Federal Reserve and Black unemployment.
Hi, this is Susanna from Cathedral City, California. I just listened to Tuesday's episode about unemployment, and I... Mm-hmm. Still don't understand why in a market where we have a global shortage of workers, why we're not aiming for 100% employed. I mean, if we need workers, and we obviously do, doesn't it make sense to just employ everyone who wants to work? Am I missing something? Help make me smart, please.
Yeah, that's fair. You want that one or am I taking this?
You can go ahead.
Okay. All right. So this is a really good question because obviously the common sense thing is we want everybody in this economy who wants a job to have a job. The problem is that you're never going to have that. You're never going to have 100% unemployment because there is a natural rate of churn in an economy. And it's anywhere from 3-ish to 4-ish%, maybe a little bit higher, of people who are leaving, stepping out of the workforce, taking time to have babies, doing whatever people do when they don't have a job. Right. So that's number one, the natural thing. Number two is let's think about what the Federal Reserve tries to do, because that's the thing we talked about with Dr. Spriggs last week. The Federal Reserve has two mandates, right? One part is maximum employment, right? The other part, though, as I sidestep to avoid pee-popping on this microphone that doesn't have a pop filter, is stable prices. And here's the catch. There's a thing called the Phillips curve, which has been in some academic doubt lately. But the bottom line of the Phillips curve is... Look, if and when unemployment gets really, really low, what usually happens is that inflation goes up, prices go up because workers become more in demand, right? Then their salaries go up. They can command higher prices. That forces companies to charge more so that they can pay those workers the higher salary. And that is the challenge. Now, the Phillips curve, as I said, has been under some, shall we say, revision lately, but it kind of doesn't work to have an economy where everybody is employed all the time. That just doesn't allow for any elasticity. It doesn't allow for any movement in interest rates or, frankly, what people do, human behavior. And so that's why we can't really go for 100% unemployment all the time.
I remember you just brought flashbacks of all that coverage we did. Oh my gosh, it's so weird with you sitting right there.
Okay, for the record, I looked at you once for like 3 seconds as I was getting a cup of coffee and a sip of coffee, and you're the one who went, "Oh my God, it's so weird." Head down.
Okay. No, but before the pandemic, we did all these stories about what's wrong with these curves. Like there's low unemployment, but inflation is stuck.
Exactly.
Oh, those were the days.
And look, so you know what's funny? Sorry, one more thing. We had conversations in the before times when unemployment was getting down to like 4-4.5%. And Mitchell Hartman did 1,000 stories on, ooh, are we at maximum employment? And we're not, because look, here we are at 3.6% today, and there's more people coming into the workforce. So,
Okay, we have another question about the labor force from Brett in Macon, Georgia, who writes... With all the job openings available to people, what skills exactly are needed? Why are these skills not being taught? Or maybe people don't like doing these jobs. And I know I read your part there, but okay, I'm going to go for it anyway. Employers talk about this quite a bit, this so-called skills gap, and that this is one of the reasons why they can't find workers to fill certain jobs, particularly these sort of high-paying jobs that don't necessarily require a college degree, like trade jobs and things like that. But a lot of economists think that this is overblown. And so we called up Catherine Zekier. She's a labor market policy analyst at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. And she said there really isn't that much evidence of a skills mismatch in our current economy. And she said basically in a lot of cases, it's not that there's a shortage of skilled workers, but a shortage of workers who are willing to take certain jobs at the wages and working conditions being offered.
So, for instance, employers in construction and trucking have often complained about skills gaps. And these are sectors that can offer some relatively higher wages for workers without college degrees, for instance, but they have really high turnover. Like trucking has really high turnover. If you have really high turnover, that's then you don't have skills mismatch because you clearly have workers and they clearly are leaving. And it's much more important to figure out why they're leaving and why those jobs aren't working for them, why those working conditions aren't working for them, than it is to say we need to train up more workers to take their place.
We should also talk about something here, I think, that we talked about with Dr. Spriggs last week when we were talking about the racial disparity in unemployment rates in this economy, that the skills gap excuse, right, and I'm using that word on purpose, has been used to explain why the black unemployment rate is effectively double the white unemployment rate and has been for decades and is, you know, as of this airing of this podcast. The catch is, of course, that the skills gap argument ignores, oh, shall we say, structural racism in this economy, mass incarceration of black Americans, hiring discrimination. So I think you have to sort of factor that thing in as well when you start talking about the way that the skills gap is talked about in the broader employment context. That's my sense.
And also, employers could close skills gaps by training workers.
Oh, yeah.
Like the idea of a skills gap proposes that it is the responsibility of the worker to walk into every job
right.
with all of the skills necessary, as opposed to it is the responsibility of the employer to train you to do a particular job. And, you know, you can make arguments on both sides of that.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's interesting. I heard a piece this morning. Couldn't make it. I was traveling. Maybe yesterday on one of the many NPR shows I listened to. And it was a worker saying, I don't want to get trained, man. I just want a job. And I'm like, okay, but
you'll make more money if you get trained.
Yeah, totally. So anyway, so that's the skills gap. Here we go. Another voice memo. Hit it.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly. This is Carly Orris from New Boston, Michigan. I have lots of electric car questions. I would like to know how Americans are supposed to be able to afford electric cars when the average income of an American is $53,000 and the average price of an electric car is $63,000.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what happens to the batteries in them once they go bad? Isn't this going to be a big environmental problem if everyone in America is supposed to drive an electric car? Also, how are Americans supposed to travel long distances and then need to recharge? I'm thinking we have five kids. What are we supposed to do for half an hour or more while we wait for an electric vehicle to charge? Thanks for making me smart.
That was a lot of questions.
Carly has some questions.
We should divvy this up. You
Carly
go first.
Has some questions. All right. So, yes, here's the thing. EVs are expensive, give or take $60,000, $65,000. And the median household income in this country is give or take $50,000, maybe a little bit more. Here's the thing that the electric car industry will tell you. Number one, you got to figure long-term costs, right? That includes not having to pay for gas, right?
Mm-hmm.
That includes some of the tax credits that you can get depending on the kind of electric car you get. There are local tax breaks, state and local tax breaks as well. Generally speaking, EVs are easier to maintain. There are fewer moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cost of the vehicle versus over a lifetime, rather than just the amount you pay to drive off the lot. That's that part of that equation.
Yeah, and you know, those tax credits alone can knock off a pretty significant chunk.
$7,500 actually, I think, is a federal tax credit.
Okay, so what happens to the batteries? This is literally a problem that the EV industry is struggling to work out right now, because there is a growing battery recycling industry. And these batteries do degrade over time. They lose something like 2% of their range per year and last about 10 years. But they are really hard to recycle. And at this point, it's more expensive to recycle most of the components than it is to just dig up the materials and make a new one. And so, and they're heavy and they're hard to transport. And so a lot of the cost comes from just like moving them to the recycling center. A recent study by UC Davis researchers found as much as 40% of the cost of recycling a battery comes from transporting it to the recycling facility. So
that's crazy. That's crazy. How is that doable? It's not actually. So,
but I mean, it's kind of like food. A lot of the food costs.
But I mean, my point being, how is recycling doable business wise?
Yeah.
If 40% of the cost of getting it to where it gets recycled is transportation, that's cray cray.
Yeah. As for charging, charging is speeding up. So if what would you do with five kids? I mean, if you can get lunch and actually. No, it's interesting. Infrastructure law that passed that has all this EV infrastructure money, they are kind of setting it up so that a lot of these EV charging stations are going to be at rest areas or at places where there's like a food stop along the major interstate system, because the idea is to put these things near facilities where that time is going to go by a little bit faster. But still some of them are getting quicker. Tesla superchargers can charge a Model S for up to 200 miles in 15 minutes, even though it does take planning. And so I'm just looking at the notes. The infrastructure package has the Biden administration giving states $5 billion to build 500,000 EV chargers over 5 years. And they're prioritizing sort of disadvantaged communities, but also sort of the main corridors to deal with some of that range anxiety.
It's totally going to get easier. I was talking to Brian Allison, one of the marketplace engineers, who has, I think it's a Model 3, and he had just driven like back and forth to like Ohio or something from California. And I asked him, number one, the range anxiety question, but number two, the charging planning question. And he's like, there are apps out there, there's software that will literally chart the course for you. And yeah, you got to kill a little time, but generally speaking, it's doable. And I think it's only going to get, I hope, it's only going to get better from here, right? Because as all the gas stations turn into electric charging stations, and we'll figure out how to zap those electrons into batteries faster, physics allowing, it'll be less onerous. But yeah, look, not everything is great about EVs, and charging is one of them.
I mean, one of my good friends who I've known since we were 6 years old, she and her husband have an EV, and they've had a Tesla for years now, and they travel more than anybody else I know, and they go everywhere. And like, they've come to DC a couple of times from Missouri, and just like, they're like, yeah, it was no problem. And they're like, yeah, it's great. We just chill the whole way here.
Yeah, totally. Good. Okay. So on the way out, super quick, today is Wednesday. We're doing What Do You Want to Know? But we're also doing a little plea, because number one, we need your help. But number two, much like charging an EV, doing this show can be hard. And it can be hard because we need resources. And that's why we come to you. There is so much news going on right now. Inflation, oil prices, cryptocurrencies, sanctions, you name it. Abortion access, reproductive rights, reproductive health is an economic story and a culture story that we've been talking about. We can't do this alone. We need your help. We need your support. We have needed it since we started at Marketplace and at Make Me Smart. And now we need it again. Marketplace.org/givesmart if you can help us out.
Yeah, and just, you know, we don't charge a fee for our reporting and the information that we really try to provide to give people better economic context. And it's y'all's support that actually provides it and gives people information that they might not otherwise have. So thank you for that. And if you can that would be great. And with that, I'm going to end our first in-person Make Me Smart. Thank you all for listening. And too bad we should have recorded this in like the weird way that we're like looking at each other across the table. It's like, you're 3D. So odd. We're going to be back tomorrow.
Yes, we will.
With news and some make me smiles.
Keep your questions coming for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Also, just for, you know, random interaction with the audience. I think that's the name of the game of this podcast. It always has been. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Leave us a voice memo at 508-UBSMART. And we'll get you on the pod.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera, today with help from Rose Conlin. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Jake Cherry was in charge down the line in L.A. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Bridget Bonner. She was in charge of all things.
Although I have to say, I operated the board on the D.C.
You did.
Side.
That's right. That's true. That's
I pushed
true.
Some buttons.
Because I don't know how. Let me just say, I don't know how.
Push some buttons, move some faders.
The engineers don't let me.
Probably with good reason.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.